Okay. Simply as I can, let me say where we're going very quickly so that it's not a mystery. On my reading, what Hegel has to do here is provide a phenomenological recapitulation of the Copernican circle. That is, he has to achieve that idea through the internal working out of how understanding proceeds to try to make sense of things, to show that instead of the world being structured like that, we have to come to discover that we demand that the world be structured like that. And that therefore we cannot separate at the end of the day how the world is from how we must think about the world. And hence we overcome subject-object dualism in doing that and discover that we can only understand what really is, not by looking at the world, but by thinking about the structure of self-consciousness. That's where we go. It's that easy. Unfortunately, getting there is not so easy.
Is that different from Kant?
What do I want to say now?
I mean, if you substitute, you substitute self-consciousness for reason, but otherwise, isn't it Kant?
It is certainly Kant, and what's going to be different is that when we discover, when we get to thinking about self-consciousness, it will turn out that we cannot think about self-consciousness in the way that Kant does. Now, we have to, as I was saying last week, think about self-consciousness as a form of human activity, rather than as a form of reflection. So this path is to bring us to an acknowledgement of the role of ourselves. So remember what everything in consciousness does is consciousness is that form of relating to the world that thinks the truth is its perception, understanding, grasp of the world. The world is essence. And I simply get it. And hence, the nature of consciousness here, consciousness wants to repudiate the role of its own activity in the constitution of experience. So what we see in sense certainty, what we see in perception, and what we're going to see even more violently here is understanding, trying to make the world have this structure without acknowledging that a structuration like this is unintelligible apart from the needs or demands of understanding itself. And hence, just to cut a long story short, perfect notion, that explanation is not a factual relation of two independent matters. Explanation is something human beings do, and only certain ways of doing it provide satisfaction. once we acknowledge that what's at stake here is ultimately not the two-tier model itself, but finding an adequate form of explaining the world, and then understanding that explaining the world is a way of thinking about the world, then how the world appears is turns out not to be independent from how we think about the world. And that's what's going to happen. So what we have needed, what perception couldn't manage, is it could not resolve the contradiction between something that was self-related, a one, to something that was other-related, multiple properties. Force, the very nature of the notion of force, is a concept of the identity of being for self by or through being for another. The force of nature. So the very nature of something that is a force of nature is it is what it is, this force of nature, by, through doing these various things. Throwing parties, making dinner, etc. Probably said too much about my relationship with my mother. So a force is only itself insofar as it forces, that is, utters or expresses itself. It can realize its identity, its self-identity, only by entering into relation with others. Force further is not immediately a perceptible reality. A force is only recognizable by going beyond the immediate and recognizing it as the inner of some multiple expression. Therefore, to recognize a force is to now understand that a single identity is manifesting itself through some total panoply of instances. Hence, the thinghood of the thing is itself an inner of some sensible multiplicity. It's a property. And that should tell us, just to show that we've got a transition here, that understanding was implicitly at work, even in perception. Because even in perception, I'm claiming we always were recognizing that the many properties were expressions of the one, and that's what made them the properties they were. So we were already understanding, but did not recognize it. And this is to say, and now this is trying to deepen the thought here, because the model of understanding, of course, is a scientific model of understanding the world. I count Plato as scientific. Right? That is, you're always looking behind the appearances to something else that is the essence, and looking at them as doing what's the explanation. And in this sense, terribly important here, we're construing science as the continuation, the necessary continuation of our ordinary perceptual activities. So it's not as if there's an independent world of everydayness and ordinary life, and then scientists go into their laboratories and do weird stuff. If the transition between perception and understanding is right, necessarily, in operating with our ordinary logic of things, our, let's call it our thoughtless logic of perception of objects, we have already committed ourselves to a scientific two-tier account of things. And therefore, it is not surprising, if this is right, that really early in Western civilization, even before Plato, we had explainers, right? Gods the idea that there were a reality behind the appearances bringing them about. So the problem is still the problem of one and many. Hence, the dialectic here will be various moments that will, in a certain sense, recapitulate the dialectic of perception. And hence, I haven't done all of them, but I was wanting to show how the perceptual model of one and many, right, maps right on to a further, more complicated model of one and many, of the kind that Hegel operates. So these are some of the variations on this structure. This is why the chapter is agony, that Hegel is operating with. And of course, behind that operation, Adam was right to say that all along there is a kind of Kantian idea of appearances and things in themselves. So consciousness to this point has been active, but does not yet recognize or acknowledge its own activity. So force and understanding will bring, that is the meaning of the dialectic here, is to bring consciousness to a recognition of its active role in the constitution of the structure of its comprehension of the world. And that all the fundamental differences that it tries to attribute to the world turn out to be internal to it. That is, its way of thinking about the world and not somehow the world in itself, independently of being thought about, that is at work here. And when we discover that, then it will turn out that consciousness is not limited, since the thing now is not an obstruction. I can guess at what it's really doing. Now, whatever it's doing, is doing whatever it is in virtue of the ways in which I find that I must think about it. So the things are no longer a limit to my understanding of them, but rather internal to that understanding, and hence again, the relation between subject-object dualism breaks down, that finally essence is going to migrate into consciousness. Okay. Well, remember Hegel's claim that science appears. Keep that thought in mind throughout this section, because Hegel's view is, if I may use a contending phrase, there can be nothing in it. Whatever is essential must appear, and hence there's nothing, if that's true, if there's nothing hidden, then it follows that there's nothing behind or beyond the world of appearances. We might want to construe the world of appearances in very complicated ways, as structured in certain ways, but it's not as if there's anything other than how things appear. In the preface, which I haven't let you read, Hegel discusses the issue under the heading of, the question is, what's the big deal with appearances? And he raises the question in paragraph 38. And he says there, now, because the system of the experience of spirit embraces only the appearance of spirit, the advance from this system to the science of the true in its true shape seems to be merely negative. And one might wish to be spared the negative as something false, and demand to be led to the truth without more ado. Why bother with the false? Appearances. The view already discussed, namely that we should begin science straight away, is to be answered at this point by examining the nature of the negative in general, regarded as what is false. And he answers this question about true and false after discussing it for a bit in paragraph 47. And here he says, philosophy, on the other hand, has to do not with the unessential determination, but with determination insofar as it is essential. Its element and content is not the abstract or non-actual, but the actual, that which posits itself and is alive within itself, existence within its own notion. All perfectly obscure. It is the process which begets and traverses its own moments. Oh, I'm sorry, Roxy. What's the German? Roxy's worried about the word moment. She's our German. Okay, I'll carry on reading while you're going. Moment. Okay, just it is. Traverses its own moments, and this whole movement constitutes what is positive in it and its truth. This truth, therefore, includes the negative also. What would be called the false, it could be regarded as something from which one might abstract. The evanescence itself must, on the contrary, be regarded as essential. Evanescence must be regarded as essential. Not as something fixed, cut off from the true, and left lying who knows where outside it, any more than the true is regarded as something on the other side, positive and dead. So this can't be just thrown away, and this simply some behind that you can't get in touch with. appearance. All this is just for the sentence. Appearance is the arising and passing away that does not itself arise and pass away, but is in itself and constitutes the actuality and the movement of the life of truth. In the chapter we're reading, that distinction is appearance and appearance as appearance. So, appearance is the arising and passing away. So there's no behind appearance. What is essence is this process of arising and passing away that itself does not arise and pass away, and that process constitutes the actuality and the movement of the light of truth. And hence the famous incomprehensible sentence, the true is thus the bacchanalian revel in which no member is not drunk, yet because each member collapses as soon as he drops out, the revel is just as much transparent and simple repose. Okay. So, he's sure that's right. but, right? So, the thought behind this chapter, and I'm just trying to motivate you to see that what the difficulty he's trying to get past is our great temptation is to think, and here, whether it's Descartes or Plato or Galileo or Aristotle or Leibniz, it doesn't matter. Now, every philosopher wanted not merely the appearances, but something lying behind them that was the true thing and that somehow was independent of them, not contaminated by them, was truly in itself. But he says that would be dead, right, if it was that. So whatever is on the left-hand side here must be something much more like a way of thinking about what's on the right-hand side and not two separate realms. So what's going to happen now in this chapter? Right? You can see my strategy here. Not to talk about the chapter, but talk about what's going to happen in it. Is that understanding is going to want to find ways of relating them that keep them separate, right? That keep something as truly essence that will be independent of those appearances. And it's going to, and this is why perception helps us here, it's going to continually run into the exact same problem that Professor Zaretsky nicely helped us see before. Namely, every time we think we have an inner that is the essence behind a manifold outer, we're going to ask, what's the content of that inner? And the inner is going to be given by the determinacy of these appearances. That is, whatever the inner is, it would be empty, indeterminate, nothing without those appearances in their determinacy and their complexity. And therefore, the search for something that would really explain them, right? Where the notion of really explain means be independent of them, uncontaminated by them. Right? And Hegel says if you do that, right, you end up with something positive and dead. That's the whole way in which every single moment of this chapter works. So this chapter really does logically recapitulate the structure of perception. So there's an irony behind the simplicity of perception and the incomprehensibility of this chapter, in that they actually both have the same thing going. Okay. Next problem. Even a cursory reading of this chapter, I don't know if it's not, we have to spend months to get beyond a cursory reading, says that it lacks a phenomenological feel. It feels less phenomenological than almost any chapter in the book. And it feels like another kind of form of argumentation is going on. And the question is why? I mean, it is phenomenological, but it feels different. Well, why? Because a two-tier model of the object is at one level, namely scientifically or metaphysically, true. Hegel is not denying that some story about gravitation, some story about attractive and repulsive forces, some story about negative and positive charges in electricity, he's not denying that scientific story is going to be... Now, he has his own wild philosophy of nature. That's another problem. But some version of this is perfectly okay. Hence, Hegel is not disputing, at least here, the general validity of Newtonian physics or the theory of magnetism or of electricity, although it can seem that way. So if he's not contesting the content, what is he doing? What he's contesting is not its scientific or even metaphysical content, he's contesting the philosophical understanding of that metaphysical content. So what's at issue here is not a philosophy of science, but rather a taking of a scientific view of the world and making it into a philosophical or metaphysical story about the world. So what he's contesting is a form of what we nowadays call scientism or reductive naturalism. And we'll see this later in the book in different ways, other versions of scientific reductionism that he'll contest in the chapter on reason. And therefore, what he's doing is saying you cannot take locked in. I want to be an underlaborer to Newton. So, okay, who else he mentioned on that list? And simply say, I clear away the underbrush so that story about how the world looks from the point of view of science is the whole story. That's what he's contesting. That you can translate that scientific understanding into how the world is. So we may say that the one thing that science does not understands the world just fine. It doesn't understand itself. So it's a scientific misunderstanding of the meaning of scientific activity that is at stake in this chapter. And hence, what's going to happen is that at every moment when understanding should, as it were, be moving to a philosophical self-understanding, an activity of self-reflection, it does something else. It concocts another screwy metaphysical scientific model. It just wants this structure to work and does not want to ask what it's doing in thinking about the world in accordance with this structure. So again, it's a refusal to acknowledge its own activity. So what the chapter will do is to make explicit through the phenomenological movement. There is a phenomenological movement, but the phenomenological movement is going to be a continual movement by where understanding is forced to see that itself is the issue and not the object.
Understanding or perception?
Understanding. Right? So understanding is the one who does these various ways of trying to concoct this. Okay, let's look at the text a little bit. Is the structure I'm now trying to lay out beginning to? No. Okay. Well, we'll just see how it goes. Do ask questions, you know, if not now, when is the same day. Paragraph 134, let's begin there. So we're operating with a genuinely two-tiered model in which being for self is being for another. And he says, that only in this way can an object have a self-identical essence. So something can be self-identical, which is again what perception wanted, what sense certainty wanted, only if it has this double movement. It is in itself by being for another. And then his first modeling of that occurs in paragraph 136. One moment then appears as the essence that has stepped to one side as universal medium or as the subsistence of independent matters. So one of the things that, and in fact all the best scholars have problems here, we don't know where he's getting this stuff from. Some of it's from Schelling. Some of it's from Kant's Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science. Maybe from Boscovich, I'm not sure. But there's probably other sorts of screwy philosophies of nature, as well as sciences of his own time going on. And the difficulty is, he's doing here what he always does, namely he takes things out of context, and he schematizes them in order to present a general philosophical position. So you just have to kind of patiently wait and let the structure of what he's talking about come through. So don't get thrown by the technical vocabulary. Almost never is a technical vocabulary important. It really always comes down to conceptual structures. But the independence of these matters is nothing else than this medium. In other words, the unconditioned universal is simply and solely the plurality of diverse universals of this kind. So the unconditioned universal is nothing but its plurality of diverse universals. That within itself, universal is undivided unity, with this plurality means, however, that these matters are each where the other is. They mutually interpenetrate, both out coming into contact with one another, because conversely, the many diverse matters are equally independent. Skip down two sentences. In other words, the matters posited as independent directly pass over into their unity, and their unity directly unfold the diversity, and this once again reduces itself to unity. But this movement is called force. One of its moments, the dispersal of the independent matters in their immediate being, is the expression of force, but force taken as that which they in which they disappeared is force proper. So it just so happens I can diagram this. So we're beginning with a many one structure. And our problem, so this is where we left things in the world of perception, and our problem is how to connect them. And we're now going to say that they're going to be connected via force, and that force is going to have two aspects to it. Force proper, and the expression of force. What does this diagram tell us? I take it as an accurate, if you read the passage, look at the diagram, I think that's about right. What does the diagram tell us? Or not tell us. Do you feel satisfied in the way you did before? Yeah, Josh?
That the many and the one are just different things. I mean, so expression and proper are just different things.
Absolutely. That we actually haven't gotten very far. That we've done some mediations. We've got something going down here, but all we've done is complicate the original story, right? By saying it's the nature of the one to express the many, but we still want to know, right? Why does it? Now it just is. So now you have proper an expression. And you're repeating the same structure over again. So the issue here is that very top of the next page, Hegel says, when we, now that's us observers, preserve the two moments in their immediate unity, the understanding to which the notion of force belongs is, strictly speaking, the notion which sustains the different moments, qua different in themselves, they are supposed to be different. In other words, what's doing the work here, if anything is doing the work here, is a way of thinking about what the notion of force means, the notion, and not some metaphysical posit. But the understanding wants to construe this notion realistically as a being apart from thought, so that each mode here is going to be the attempt to keep the internal difference, the thought difference between one and many, force proper, force in its expression, to keep that internal difference external. A real external relation. So, what understanding wants is a structure in which X explains why, where the crux for it is the nature of the relata. Everything in this chapter can be shifted into a matter of intonation. What Hegel wants to say is X explains why. And he's going to shift all the thinking about what's important into how we think about how they're connected, not into the structure of the items connected. Hegel's language, then, throughout the chapter is neutral with respect to particular metaphysical theories, since he's here making a phenomenological point about an epistemic temptation, namely the epistemic temptation to explain the manifold of appearances through the unity of what does not itself appear and what is configured as a metaphysically or ontologically independent realm. So, it's important that this be the invisible. And once you realize that this is the invisible, or force proper, as the invisible, explaining the visible, or the intelligible, explaining the sensible, then you begin to think that we can put a lot of different things in this place. You can do, as he is doing here, go below and think that we put forces or atoms or primary qualities underneath. Or you can do it above and say it's platonic universal. Or laws, or anything else you want to say that is separate from and independent from the appearances. Okay, paragraphs. So, for example, paragraphs 137 to 141. Are the attempt to show that the postulation of force has, and what force is doing here, it's forming the glue holding the many together, must contain a logical complexity. And it turns out that that logical complexity must eventually work its way back into the notion of force itself. That is, one force cannot do all the work that the notion of force must do if it is to succeed in explaining how there are things or objects at all. So I suppose, or I am supposing, that, if I can find it quickly, that he's thinking about something like Proposition 6 in Kant's Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science. I take it none of you have read this book, so when I say that, I know you have no idea what Kant is going to do here, and I'm just going to read it briefly, since it's fascinating by itself, is try to show, and by the way, this, these crazy Germans, this became a massive source of argument in German philosophy after Kant. This is an attempt to show a priori that there must be at least two forces, that you cannot have a world with just one force. And the proposition 6 reads, by mere attraction, maybe gravity, by mere attraction, without repulsion, no matter is possible. That's the thesis. And Kant says, I won't read the whole thing, but it's actually quite simple. He says, attractive force is that moving force of matter whereby it compels another to approach it. That's right. Compels another to approach it. Consequently, when such force is found among all parts of matter, then it endeavors by means of this force to diminish the distance of its parts from one another, and hence the space they together occupy. Anyone see what the problem is going to be here? Imagine a world with just one force in which everything tries, right? You just, you know, that everything's going to collapse into an instant. And that's exactly what Kant is going to argue. Now, nothing can hinder the action of a moving force except another moving force opposed to it. The force that is opposed to attraction is repulsive force. Therefore, by mere approach, and without repulsive forces, all parts of matter would approach one another without hindrance and diminish the space that matter occupies. And there it goes, right? And therefore, there'd be no space, and matter would just be a black hole. So there must be at least two forces for matter to be possible. Hegel's analysis here simply underlines Kant's conclusion, namely, these two, whether they're attractive or matter, both belong inseparably to the concept of matter. Therefore, there must be a minimum of two forces. And therefore, we have now an a priori account of the constitution of matter. So, paragraph 141, the essence rather consists simply and solely in this, that each is solely through the other. What each thus is immediately no longer is, since it is the other. They have thus, in fact, no substances of their own which might support and maintain them, etc., etc. Now, the point that Hegel wants to make here is that force remains only through the thought of it. Now, Kant is attempting, in fact, such an a priori constitution. Hegel's point is that the metaphysical oomph, which is supposed to allow force to be the kind of ontological glue, the cement of the universe, is nothing but a reflective construction. exactly the kind of construction you just read. That's why I read the passage. That is, what I want to say is that what the understanding is doing is in fact doing something like Kant's a priori construction of matter, in which what's happening? In which the intelligibility of the world is being gotten by showing that there must be more than this, so forth. But then saying, no, this is not a priori, is projecting it back out into saying, this is the way the world is. Now, I can see the puzzle on your face. What am I not making clear here? The suggestion I want is that our willingness to consider that the world is composed of attractive and repulsive forces does not get its power, its, what I'm calling, metaphysical oomph, from the notion of force itself, but from the thought process of the a priori construction, whereby we are able to conceive of a world in terms of two forces in a way we cannot conceive of a world in terms of one force. So the difference between the two here is the difference between thinking of this situation metaphysically and thinking of it constructively. Understanding wants all the insight allowed by a priori construction while repudiating that it gets its insight that way. It wants it to come from the matter itself. Somebody asked a question. I can see the puzzlement. Failing somehow. Yeah.
Maybe just to switch the terminology.
Yeah.
Is the many the exponens and the one the exponendum?
Yep.
Or vice versa? Okay.
And but that's going to be the problem. That's wonderful. So part of the issue is that there's an exponens and an exponendum. And what Hegel is going to continually do is show that the exponens cannot be what it thinks it is without the exponendum. Concerns the role of the understanding itself in the construction of these relationships. Let me try we can come back to the more other stuff next week and fill out the story. Let me try going to the end of the story and see if that will help. I can see that the puzzle is deep. Paragraph 163.
who are just using the word, relaxed maker, and see if this will get us where we need to be thinking about. We can work backwards from here. So, infinity, and we knew we were going to get there, right? Infinity, or this absolute unrest of pure self-movement, that's the bit I already read you about back in the Revel, in which whatever is determined one way or another as being is rather the opposite of this determinateness. This, no doubt, has been from the start the soul of all that has gone before, but it is the inner world that it has first freely and clearly shown itself. And now this is the bit I wanted to talk about. Appearance, or the play of forces, already displays it, but it is as explanation that it first freely stands forth, and in being finally an object for consciousness, as that which it is, consciousness is thus self-conscious. The understanding, one explains many. Okay? Let's just think about that for a moment. One explains many. It supersedes the differences present in the law. Differences which have already become pure differences but are still indifferent and posited in single unity and force. Move down. But this movement or necessity is thus still a necessity and a movement of the understanding, or the movement as such is not the understanding's object. On the contrary, in this movement, the understanding has objects, positive and negative electricity, distance, force or attraction, and a thousand other things which constitute the content of the moment of the movement. The reason why explaining affords so much self-satisfaction is just because in it, consciousness is, so to speak, communing directly with itself. And then a slightly embarrassing phrase, enjoying only itself, although it seems to be busy with something else, it is in fact occupied only with itself. Overcome me. Why is this the conclusion? Because the search here of the one and the many is to find a structure that will answer the question, why? That's what we're doing. We're trying to get a structure that will answer our why. But to say that that's why, what we're doing, why the many, how do we explain the many, and therefore what we're looking for is a good explanation. That's what we're really looking for. But things don't explain things. I mean, that's simply mixing up two vocabularies. Explaining, and there are two ways of explaining, let's assume for the moment, deduction and induction. Okay, we can explain what there is by deducing it, or explain by providing an induction that will get us to the law. Right? Those are human activities of comprehension. So when we finally try to understand what's going to work here, what we're asking for is what is going to count as a good explanation. Not what is the structure of the universe, but what is going to count as a good explanation of the universe. And in order to do that, we have to think about the nature of scientific inquiry. Not the nature of the world, but the nature of scientific inquiry. Why we would prefer one kind of theory over another kind of theory. And once we realize that that's what we're going to be doing, that is, we're not going to be understanding the world, but understanding scientific theory construction, then our object, the truth of science, is not science, but the meaning of science. The truth of science, the reason science matters, the reason we care about science, is not merely because of its content, but because it allows us understanding of the world. But understanding of the world is a matter of our finding good explanations that have models to them, that have a certain bunch of criteria. Well, who sets up this criteria? Who determines what is going to count as good science? And the answer Hegel's going to give is, we do. We, as a community, in dialogue with one another, work out the terms for an adequate theory of science. And we operate with criticism. Right? So I don't know if you can help with this. I'm gripped by the fact that two books have just come out saying that string theory isn't it. And it's fascinating because string theory has been the theory of physics for the last 20 years, and the mathematics of it is astounding, and it turns out it's empty. It's just good mathematics. It's great mathematics. But so far, it's made no difference in the physical understanding of anything. Right? This is the problem, right? It's perfectly empty. Now, who says that? We say that. So there's no, ultimate theory, is it? Rather, will it fill the role of doing a job? And the answer is, will it provide a good explanation? So when we're doing science, this is Hegel's kicker, if you wish, this is the embarrassing phrase, we are communing with our own models of understanding. So of course we say, I suspect that theory is true because it's simple and elegant and powerful. But wait, simple, elegant, what does that have to do with force and expression? It doesn't. But it does. We can't talk about force and expression without talking about theories that are simple and powerful and deductively rich. Now, why is that important? Because the standpoint of consciousness, which is what this section was about, claimed that the truth of human beings in the world was their representations of the world. That they're being in the world via their representations. And that the theory of force and understanding was to be the most robust version of that representational self-understanding of human beings. So the meaning of this is that we are not related to the world via our representations of it, because science is not fundamentally a representational activity. Science fundamentally is an explanatory activity, an activity of achieving good or adequate. So what Hegel is trying to do in these passages that I've been looking at is trying to show that the understanding is trying to get in the world, by the way it talks about essence and appearance, a connection between them that can't be had between things, between objects, that the connection that would make it work is not about the world. It's about an adequate comprehension of the world. That is, about explanation. So it puts its interest in the wrong place. Even more puzzling. Okay. Let us stop there. What we will do next week is begin with what's an understanding. I'll go through some more passages. We'll try to think about this movement. Because what I'm trying to do here is to get at the current concern, and we will begin, we'll make the transition to self-consciousness. We'll do the master-slave, but we'll do the transition.